400-verse treatise by Aryadeva. Chapter 9, Indicating the Meditations for Refuting Static Functional Phenomena. All functional phenomena arise as a fact of being the result of a collection of causes and circumstances. Therefore, there's no such thing as a static functional phenomenon that is causeless and truly existent. Except for the thusly gone able sage Buddhas, there isn't anyone who can simultaneously cognize non-conceptually just how functional phenomena are both non-static and devoid of true existence. Whatever functional phenomena there are do not exist just at any place or at any time without relying on causes and circumstances. Therefore, there is no such thing whatsoever as a functional phenomenon that is static, anytime, anywhere. There is no such thing as a functional phenomenon without a cause, and no such thing as something static having a cause. Therefore, concerning a static functional phenomenon established from no cause, it is said that such indeed cannot be established as an object of valid cognition, even by the omniscient one. Suppose you vaisheshika say the criterion for knowing something to be non-static is from seeing that it has been produced, while if you cannot see it has been produced, that makes it static. Well then, from seeing that it has been produced, you merely know something to be existent. Therefore, not seeing an Atman or self as having been produced makes such a so-called static object non-existent. Space and so forth are understood to be static and substantially existent because they perform the function of serving as objects of the cognition for them, only by ordinary folks such as you, Vaibhashikas, who do not correctly understand Buddhist texts. The wise do not see such things as objects of valid cognition, even on a worldly conventional level. Directional space, such as that of the eastern direction, does not abide everywhere. Because of that, it's extremely clear that directional space indeed has directions and other divisions, such as parts. Thus, it cannot be a static functional phenomenon in the way you Vaisheshikas define it as being both all-pervasive and partless. And any type of time that exists, allowing either the occurrence or prevention of a functional phenomenon to be seen at its proper time, must, in order to function as a cause, come under the influence of other factors. Therefore, it itself becomes a result, and thus cannot be static as you Vaidantikas claim. Any cause that does not have a result cannot exist as a cause. Because of that, you are forced to conclude that every cause must itself be a result, for its ability to produce its result is itself the result of other conditions. If a cause transforms, it becomes the cause of something else. Whatever has transformation cannot be called static. Further, a functional phenomenon that has something static, such as time as its cause, should arise at its proper time, even from other supporting conditions not coming about. Thus it becomes something arising independently, in which case such a functional phenomenon would become the opposite of something that relies on causes. After all, how can a functional phenomenon that arises from something static be non-static? A cause and effect that have dissimilar characteristics can never be seen. Consider the ultimately smallest particles which you Vaisheshikas say are static and partless. How can they form an object? Any such particles that had certain sides, which when they met were the cause for an object's forming, and certain sides which are not the cause, would therefore have various parts. How is it logical for that which has various parts to be static by your definitions? The objects that would be the result of the meeting of such static particles, which as a cause are round, do not have the same round shape and size. Therefore, it is also unreasonable for such particles to join with their entire natures merging on all sides all at once to form an object. Suppose you said that they do not actually merge on all sides, since you do not accept that the place occupied by one particle can also be occupied by another. Well then, because of that, you are forced to say that in order to build up a gross visible object, they must meet with at least some sides not joining, since it cannot be accepted that each of the causal particles and the resultant objects they form are both equal in size. But then, if some sides join and some do not, these particles cannot be partless. any ultimately smallest particle that has an eastern side also has an eastern part. Therefore, any particles that have directional sides cannot be asserted as particles that are the ultimately smallest partless particles. Any ultimately smallest particle that, when moving, has both a space before it that it takes and one behind it that it gives up cannot be partless, since it has a front and a back. Or else you would have to say that such particles cannot be something that moves to form an object. And any ultimately smallest particle that has no first part in front, that has no middle, and any that has no end in the rear, cannot be situated before any mind. As this is so, by what kind of valid yogic cognition could it be seen? With the production of its result, a cause disintegrates. Therefore, particles as a cause must be non-static and impermanent. Otherwise, whatever had static eternal particles as its cause would have its cause and effect as existing simultaneously. A functional phenomenon that can have its motion obstructed, which implies a change of state, and yet is static, cannot be seen anywhere. Therefore, the Buddha has never said that particles are static and permanent. Now, liberation, as the noble truth of true stoppings, in being static and permanent, is different from the binding truth of true origins of suffering, the bound truth of true sufferings, and the method truth of true pathway minds. If, however, it had substantial existence because of performing the function of serving as a cause for the cognition of it, as you Vaibhashikas claim, it should produce an effect, but nothing at all arises from it. Therefore, such a substantially existent stopping cannot be said to be liberation. You also incorrectly think that in the nirvana state beyond sorrow, without any residue, aggregates do not exist at all, and a person or conventional me relying on them does not exist either. But as only a truly existent person who has passed beyond sorrow cannot be seen anywhere, how can nirvana itself be substantially existent? At the time of liberation, when there is a parting from craving, if the Atman or self had a nature of consciousness, as you Samkhas assert, what point would there be to this, since according to you there would be no objects for it to perceive? And if it were to exist then and not be conscious, this amounts to what is clearly not so according to your system, since you assert that the self with the nature of consciousness is static and permanent. If a self that was liberated had true existence, then even if it existed in this condition as having only the potential for consciousness, this would still be unreasonable, since by not actually being conscious, it contradicts your definitions. And if a truly existent self did not exist with consciousness when liberated, it wouldn't be reasonable for it ever to have thought about becoming released from recurring samsaric existence, since being truly existent and static, it could never have been conscious at all. Thus, it is definite that people who are liberated from suffering do not have an independently existing self, different from that which can merely be labeled on the basis of their aggregate factors of experience. Because of that, it is said that it is best to eliminate grasping at a truly existent self in all respects. But you may object that worldly ones easily accept the conventional existence of these ordinary things, while not doctrinally asserting at all their ultimate true existence. So why bother trying to refute true existence? After all, for worldly ones, the slightest things have existence, but do not have ultimate true existence. Well then, just because they do not have doctrinally based grasping at things to have true existence, this does not negate or eliminate their having automatically arising grasping.